Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley on the campaign trail in South Carolina, where early voting begins Monday in the GOP primary. Haley kicking off her bus tour in the town of Newberry today. Supporter Fran Stanek says she's concerned about the mounting legal challenges Donald Trump is facing.
It's chaos, and I think it is a distraction, and I don't want to have to live with that distraction for the next 4 years.
Trump remains the front runner in Haley's home state, where she served as governor. In Florida, two people are dead after a plane made an emergency landing Friday on Interstate 75 near Naples, colliding into a car. Authorities say three people survived. That flight originated from Ohio, and authorities say the pilot reported engine failure, but the cause remains under investigation. Faced with public outcry, Hungary's conservative president has resigned Saturday over her pardon of a man convicted as an accomplice in a child sexual abuse case. This is ABC News. Prince Harry speaking out after agreeing to a substantial undisclosed settlement Friday in a lawsuit against the Mirror Group newspapers. It follows a judge's ruling that Harry was the victim of an unlawful information gathering, including tabloid phone hacking. That legal settlement has not cooled tensions between Harry and former publisher Piers Morgan. ABC's Inez de la Cotara is outside Buckingham Palace with more.
Friday's hearing confirming the prince will be awarded damages and his legal fees will be covered by the tabloid paper's publisher. The prince using his win to take a swipe at the paper's former editor, Piers Morgan, issuing a statement saying Morgan knew perfectly well what was going on and should be investigated, adding, "We call again for the authorities to uphold the rule of law and to prove that no one is above it." Morgan denies the allegations.
Prince Harry still has ongoing cases against other British publications. Harry recently traveled to England to visit his father, King Charles, following his cancer diagnosis. I'm Michelle Franz in ABC News.
Getting your biggest tax refund from Jackson Hewitt can lead to some spirited reactions.
Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
Jackson Hewitt is so sure that you'll get your biggest refund that if they don't, you get your money back plus $100.
Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
And Jackson Hewitt also guarantees the accuracy of your return for life.
Hewitt, yeah!
So don't just sit there. For your biggest refund guaranteed, walk into a Jackson Hewitt today and dance out Jackson Hewitt, yeah!
988 Wisconsin Lifeline, how can I help you?
Share hope, find purpose when you become a 988 Wisconsin Lifeline counselor. The 988 Wisconsin Lifeline provides free and confidential support to anyone experiencing a mental health or substance use crisis. Staffed by Family Services, 988 has experienced tremendous growth, and more statewide counselors are needed to answer calls, texts, and chats to the Lifeline. If you want to share hope and find purpose in your next job, apply now. You can work remotely from anywhere in Wisconsin. Training is provided and flexible hours are available. 988 Wisconsin Lifeline counselors enjoy competitive compensation and benefits packages. Most importantly, you can share hope and find purpose when you become a 988 Wisconsin Lifeline counselor. Apply today at 988lifelinecounselor.org. Family Services is an equal opportunity employer.
Paid for by grants from SAMHSA and the Wisconsin Department of Health Services.
More than a third of Wisconsin farmland is leased, that according to federal data. Kelly Wolfert is a farm management outreach specialist with the University of Wisconsin Extension. She suggests renting land is the only real option for new and emerging farmers. That's because current market conditions put owning property out of reach, and these individuals also have to invest in things such as new equipment, creating even bigger disadvantages.
Land is very expensive when you're competing against farmers who have assets already built up that they can leverage in order to afford that land.
Her team is trying to educate smaller operations about the dynamics of leasing agricultural property and what their rights are. Wilford says it's important to make sure you have your lease in writing with clear terms. She adds that being more vocal about conservation practices you might deploy could help get a break on the cost of the rent. Steve Okanek, a regional educator with UW Extension, says lacking social connections in a farming community you're eyeing for production is another barrier.
Especially if you're a new person coming into a neighborhood, it can be very difficult. It comes down to networking.
He says you should treat your quest for land almost like a job search, where establishing trust and familiarity might result in more leads. This outreach comes as the nation sees an influx of beginner farmers trying to get a bigger share of the market. In the most recent census of agriculture, there was a 17% increase in the number of farmers with less than 5 years of experience. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Becoming sunny this afternoon, we'll see a high near 36. Northwest winds at about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Clear tonight, low 20s. For your Sunday, we'll start off with some clouds, then sunny again in the afternoon with a high near 37. On Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 40. Right now, 31 degrees.
Your home for the Devil's Advocates. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. The talk of Green Bay. 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Cripescast. This is the podcast where we talk to people for and or from the Midwest, and we are powered by Everlight Solar. Hey guys, how we doing? Welcome to the Cripescast this week. My guest is the creator of Mystery Science Theater 3000, Joel Hodgson. Joel is sort of Midwest royalty. Mystery Science Theater is a, for those of you who don't know, it's a show. It started off on local Minneapolis public television, and it's You got a B-movie playing, and you've got people riffing on it. And you've probably seen it around streaming over the years, but it's an incredible show, an incredible property. It's such an honor to talk to Joel and learn about his career. He was, by the age of 24, he was in L.A. doing stand-up on Letterman, SNL. He was offered his own TV show, his own role on a TV sitcom, and decided to give it all up and go back to the Midwest. And yeah, as you'll hear, he just started playing with robots and toys, and you know, every step of his life, though in the moment may seemingly have felt bizarre, it all led to a really cool creation. So it was a real pleasure to talk with Joel, and I met Joel actually at Joey's Song, where I met a bunch of guests on the show. Joey's Song, again, a benefit for children with epilepsy. We do it every year. All right. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we will get to my conversation with Mystery Science Theater creator Joel Hodgson. Hey, how's it going?
Good, man.
Where are you, man? Where are you? Where do you reside? Do you live in Milwaukee?
Yeah.
My mom's from Milwaukee. Did you know Dan Harmon's from Milwaukee?
I did, because of a fellow named Rolly Cafaro. Do you know a guy named Rolly Cafaro at all? He's an improv guy, and he used to work with Dan Harmon. Yeah. And yeah. That, do you know Dan at all?
Yeah, for sure. I know him pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, because you guys probably were in the same circles for quite a bit. Did you meet when you went out to LA, or did you meet?
Those guys are younger than me, him and Rob Schraub. And those guys are younger than me. I was done with my first run at Mystery Science Theater when I met those guys, and they were just coming out. They just came out to LA. So after MST, I moved out to LA, and they had moved out. So they were just really just starting out. They had an improv group called the Dead Alewives. Remember, you know?
Yeah. You ever heard that? Oh yeah. That's a great name, man. Cause, yeah. Anyone in the Midwest or around the Great Lakes knows that smell. You know, when the Alewives have their mass extinctions. We actually had a fellow named Dan Egan on, who our conversation was about the Great Lakes and the sort of, you know, mass die-offs of the Alewives and why it happens and zebra mussels and all this and that. That's a great name, man.
I know, right? Super cool.
So when you met Dan, did you know that, or did you have a feeling that sort of he was going to be set up for the kind of success that he has had? Or were you like, who knows?
Well, it's funny. It's really funny because we used Schraub as a writer. He was a remote writer on Mystery Science Theater. And it was just based on the strength of his like submission. We had a few outside writers. And I think Harmon worked on a couple, but it was uncredited. So Schraub and Harmon wrote on MST. And so that I ran into him at Comic-Con in San Diego, they had a comic book that Scud the Disposable Assassin, which is his epic comic book. And Dan had worked on it. And that's all they had done when I met him. And so they just, that was before community and everything. And so, but they were just both really super clever, really great guys. So we were just friends. That was all before he became a superstar and Rick and Morty and all that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of funny how you, how Midwest people go out to some place like Los Angeles and then somehow find each other, you know?
It's really true. You kind of gravitate towards those people. Same with the Minneapolis group. You know, I got to, you know, you kind of hang, they, you know, they hang together, right? And it's the same with any, it's the same with any city, right? If they're from Chicago, if they're from whatever, and they go to LA, they all kind of find each other, you know what I mean? They kind of hang out. So it's really funny the way that works. I was going to say about, Wisconsin, when I was growing up, I didn't know anybody famous from Wisconsin. There was nobody that I knew of. There was no like Wikipedia. There's no IMDb. It's like it would have been great if like who's the guy from Willy Wonka, Gene Wilder, right?
Yeah.
It would be nice if they would have done like things like when the players do the IDs during the Packer game, yeah. Like Wilder, Willy Wonka, Marquette University or something like that, right? William Dafoe, character actor, Madison. Like, you know what I mean? You didn't get that.
No, they say their college or their hometown or something.
So I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anybody that was doing anything when I was in, I kind of grew up in Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. Do you know where that is?
Yes. In fact, I recorded an album over the summer in Fort Atkinson, right to the ice cream place, that pink ice cream shop.
What's the name of that place? Is it like is it named after a fish? Was it a studio or was it a live venue?
It was a studio. And and the name right now slips my mind, which is not good, but it's a great studio. Have you been there recently?
I go every year. I drag my kids to Fort Atkinson and show them where I grew up and all that. And it was funny growing up there because, you know, when you're in Fort Atkinson, they don't call it Fort Atkinson. They call it Fort, right? You're in Fort. And it had such a strong brand identity. They built a freaking fort in the town. It's like the symbol of the town is in the town. And when you're a little kid, you just go, oh, I got it. It's Fort. It's easy to remember. Right.
Yeah.
There's a lot of Wisconsin cities like that. If you just go down the road to Lake Ripley, there's symbols like an umbrella, right? They paint the water tower like an umbrella. It's like they do all the work for you. So it's easy to remember. Next city is Cambridge. There's a bridge. So it's super simple. The Rock River's got rocks in it, right? You go down the river, it's Black Hawk Island. There's hawks there. It all falls apart, though, when you get to Lake Koshkonong. Like, what's a Koshkonong, right?
Yeah. Or you go to Wisconsin Rapids and you realize there's no rapids in Wisconsin.
Oh, right.
Rapids,
yeah. What's going on? Where's my rapids?
Yeah. And Green Lake does not look green, you know?
Spooner. Like, where's the big spooner, right? Like, like the muskie, where's the muskie for the
Hayward,
right? Yeah. Like they should have a giant spoon in Spooner. Like it seems like a natural.
It would be. You know what would happen, though, is that Hayward would. Spooner's got. Who's Spooner's big rival?
Rival in what?
Like who writes? Yeah. There's this one bridge that says Spooner blows, and that's their whole thing. So I forget, I should know this. It's not Hayward, but anyway, Spooner blows. They just put like a big fan next to the spoon, you know? Anyway, there's fun stuff there. We were in Brainerd and they had this big old Brainerd, Minnesota. And they had this big old water tower there that, they call it Paul Bunyan's flashlight.
Did you ever go to the Paul Bunyan amusement park up there back in the day?
No, I didn't. Did you go to the Paul Bunyan amusement park?
Sure. And it was electrifying because, you know, the deal is they'd canvas your names as you went in. You didn't know. Your parents said, it's Jimmy Joel and Julie Hodson from Fort Atkinson. And then you walk in and freaking Paul Bunyan goes, and a welcome to Jimmy Joel and Julie Hodson from Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin. And it was like it was like a waking dream, right? This giant thing was talking to you. And I think they moved it. I think it's been moved, but you used to be able to see it from the highway. I don't know if it's running anymore.
Man, that I just got to say is a lot of pressure for that Paul Bunyan to actually get these names pronounced correctly.
Yeah.
He's got some wild.
And if you're a kid and he gets it wrong, you just got to go with it.
Yeah.
I'll walk forward. It's like the Wizard of Oz kind of like, come forward,
And people just adapt the name that Paul Bunyan pronounces it as. It's kind of like
our name now. Yeah. This is who we are.
It's like Ellis Island, you know? If they screwed up at Alice, Paul Bunyan Hodgson, messed it up.
We're Hodgesons now. What about Barron? What do they go wrong? How do they go wrong with Barron?
I think they've done a few different versions. So technically Barron's, and then I think there was an H in it. And then I don't know, because there's not a ton of different Barron spellings, but like, you know, there was an H situation somewhere. But I think if you go back far enough, you can find it, your name spelled. And also there was no spell check back then. So it was probably just, you don't know if it was the original way or just a misspelling. And does it really matter?
What are the countries of origin of the Barron family? Like, who are they?
I don't know. I mean, German.
All the white places, right?
Yeah, this is a hodgepodge of white places. Yeah, nothing really exciting going on. Although I will say that my great, potentially great, two to three great uncle, Ed Bernard, invented the ice cream sundae in Two Rivers, Wisconsin, right up there in Trivers. True story. True story, according to my grandma.
What a happy day that must have been.
It was a happy day until there was a place in, I believe, Rochester, what's the place in New York that has the first letter that starts with an I? Iliad, I think. Iliad, yeah. It's Iliad, New York or something. They took the... The title for the first ever ice cream sundae. It's since been hotly disputed between Two Rivers and I believe it's Iliad. And there's no defining thing saying it's from Wisconsin, except if you ask me, I'll say it's for sure from Wisconsin. But it's not like that. It's not like there was generational wealth from the invention of the ice cream sundae, because... I think if he's awesome. In my family, he probably had a gambling love for gambling too.
There's a lot of skeletons in the closet, man.
I know, especially when you go back that far.
Yeah, you know? Oh, sure, man.
Like they were doing some wild stuff back.
I know my great grandfather was in Toma, and he was the guy who built the caskets. He had a furniture store. And he built the caskets, but he was also the fiddler in town. He's an Irish guy. And so he'd play the funerals, he'd play the weddings, and he'd make out with the widows, you know, scamming on the lake. I think they got the first divorce in Wisconsin.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Again, no generational wealth from that either.
Yeah. There's no caskets. There's no, I mean, the furniture guy, it makes sense that the furniture guy would also make the caskets.
But you then know, the thing, he's double booking because he sells a casket and he says, you're going to need music, you know?
He's probably triple booking, you know? He makes sells a chair for someone and he's like, you know, I'll be buying this back shortly, you know?
And yeah, then I made your cradle, and now here comes the casket.
Cradle to the grave, just like that. That's quite the business. You don't get a whole lot of furniture making, furniture coffin making fiddle players anymore, which is...
Oh, for sure. It was really sobering when it kind of came out, because I always thought, you know, we were very, truly born again family. My grandpa was a minister. And then it comes out that great-grandpa was just off the rails. The church was where I kind of started to get my chops, though, because it's like I was a ventriloquist when I was a kid and did magic. You know, I started out doing magic like in about fourth grade. And there are lots of places to work, like banquets and all kinds of stuff. So I really got, it was cool. It was great. There was lots of places that wanted entertainment, you know.
That's really cool. I was going to ask, like, where sort of the creative spark started with you.
Strangely enough, my dad was really creative. His mom was the one whose dad was the philandering furniture maker. And he was very creative, too. I got to see him do really fun stuff. Like, he was the first guy I ever saw. I mean, in some ways, he kind of, like, he was the principal of my grade school. I went to Rockwell Grade School in Fort Atkinson, and he was my principal. And then later he worked for another, like, Purdy or Barry School in Fort Atkinson. And in the summertime, those guys, the teachers would do lawn maintenance, and that's how they kept, you know, getting paid, as they do lawn maintenance during the summer. And my dad found this giant cabinet of magic lantern slides, like just slides of people in fields and on rivers. And he used to do funny slideshows with them when I was growing up. Like, he'd do wedding receptions, and he was really funny. And so he'd riff on these slides, right? And so I grew up watching that. It's not that different from MST, really.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So he was very, I didn't realize it growing up. I just go, yeah, that's what your dad does. But he was very creative and did really cool, like, interesting stuff. He was a teacher. So a lot of the stuff he'd do was based on teaching. But he was really, really engaged and creative. So I grew up with that. My mom, they were do-it-yourselfers, you know, like, they renovated their house and put up paneling. You know, there's a lot in the 60s and the 70s. That's how everybody fixed up their places, right?
Oh, sure. I just put some wood paneling over it.
Yeah, exactly. So they were doing that like crazy. And so I got into magic, and I found out about it through the church. There was a guy in our church called Charlie Fairchild. He was also the Santa Claus in Fort Atkinson.
Oh, so, that Charlie.
Yeah, he's a big, heavy guy. And he did magic. And I went up to him afterwards and I go, like, how do you get this stuff? And he told me, he goes, it's from a magic supply house. And I'm like, my mind's just reeling. And later I found out it was Abbott's Magic, which was across the lake in Colon, Michigan, across. And so I started ordering magic from there and doing shows. So that's kind of how I got my chops. I did that through college. I did, like, open for bands. I did coffee shops, coffee houses. And then the comedy thing started, stand-up started. That was right when cable was starting. So I was just in the right place at the right time. I did stand-up my whole senior year of college, and my thesis, as stupid as it sounds, I was a communication major. So I did my thesis about my stand up. And I headlined my senior year of college at a place called the Comedy Gallery. So I did like 6 weeks of, you know, just, I don't know, it was like, you know, the usual bookings in clubs back then was Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. You do a show on Sunday. And so I did that my senior year, and I got my chops that way. And then after college, I moved to LA, and like in a few months, I got on Letterman. And then a few months later, I got on Saturday Night Live, and then I got on HBO's Young Comedian Special. So in the course of like 3 years, I'd done like 5 Lettermans and 5 Saturday Night Lives, and was a club guy for 3 years before Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, I mean, that is a That's such a wild pathway, especially at a time when, I mean, comedy, where was comedy in the sort of in pop culture? It was kind of just
maybe on a variety, you know, you get on a talk show, get on Carson, get on Letterman. Like I guess it was my senior year. I saw Letterman was when he did his first, he used to do a daytime show, right? And then he moved to late night. And I saw it, and that's all I wanted was to get on Letterman. I thought it was so great. I liked him so much. But he was a Midwestern guy. He's from like Indianapolis or something. Yeah. So that's all I wanted was to get on Letterman, and all that other stuff just kind of came with it.
And then it happens. I mean, I kind of, even before we get to Letterman, like when you're in Minneapolis and you're just starting off, you're doing the clubs. I mean, that's a fast rise in a year, in your senior year while you're doing school, to go through school and then get enough reps to be headlining just in a year. I mean, did you feel as though you were on fast rise, or did you feel you were sort of a big fish in a small pond?
Well, it was so early. Like I'll give you an example. Like, this is like one of the clubs I worked at was called the Comedy Cabaret. That's where I kind of started. Mm-hmm. And it was improv and stand up. So it's kind of a hybrid. And I fit in really good there because I just did props and bad magic and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it really suited me really good. There was a stand up club in town called Mickey Finn's, but those guys were just by the book, straight monologists. And they thought you were cheating if you brought props on stage. Like, they didn't like me. Mm-hmm. And so I found a good place to reside. And then one of the guys split and he started his own club called the Comedy Gallery. A guy named Scott Hansen, who's really good stand up. And so that it just kind of, everything kind of went my way. But because I had basically been producing my own show since I was in fourth grade, it was easy for me to keep adding stuff. And once I started to get some traction, it was just really easy. I just, adding bits was very easy for me. And I was very, you know how it is when you just try to do comedy for real, you got to treat it like it's your job. And you got all these friends who are working 8 hours a day on something they don't care about. Right. And you got this great thing and you just go, well, I can work on this for 8 hours a day. But a lot of times comics aren't like that. They don't know how to control it. They don't have that journeyman work ethic and they just kind of wait for inspiration. But I just said, okay, this is my gig now. I'm going to spend 8 hours a day. If I spend an hour or two in a club, let's say I was in LA and I'd work the Comedy Store every night. So that's 2 hours, but I had 6 hours to kind of prep and build stuff and write. So I just had, you know, when you come from the Midwest and you don't really believe you're a charmed being, you go, I can work at this. I can get better. Right. And so that's what helped me a lot, is just that kind of, I'm going to put the time in whether I'm inspired or not. I'm going to do this. And it really helped, you know.
That's such a Midwest thing. Yeah. You grow up believing you're not a charmed being.
Right.
There's nothing special about you. Go mow the freaking lawn.
Where the fans own the team. This is the talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
ABC News, I'm Michelle Franzen. Republican presidential hopeful Nikki Haley on the campaign trail in South Carolina, where early voting begins Monday in the GOP primary. Haley kicking off her bus tour in the town of Newberry today. Supporter Fran Stanek says she's concerned about the mounting legal challenges Donald Trump is facing.
It's chaos, and I think it is a distraction. And I don't want to have to live with that distraction for the next 4 years.
Trump remains the front runner in Haley's home state, where she served as governor. In Florida, two people are dead after a plane made an emergency landing Friday on Interstate 75 near Naples, colliding into a car. Authorities say three people survived. That flight originated from Ohio, and authorities say the pilot reported engine failure, but the cause remains under investigation. Faced with public outcry, Hungary's conservative president has resigned Saturday over her pardon of a man convicted as an accomplice in a child sexual abuse case. This is ABC News.
the Bucks finally get a win. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens. At Super Bowl 58 with sports, the Bucks outplayed the Hornets to a 120-84 win for Milwaukee. Doc Rivers says the Bucks are adapting to his changes on defense.
I thought our defensive execution, I didn't see our guards get picked tonight. Like, they got over picks tonight, you know.
NFL, Jordan Love here at the Super Bowl, making appearances and doing some interviews. I asked him, what was the turning point for the Packers last season?
Man, there are so many things. I don't think you can pinpoint one thing that turned a point in the season. I think it's just a collection of being together through a whole year. Obviously, we had a lot of young guys that haven't been together. So just building that connection every day in the facility. Obviously, we did some things outside of the facility to help grow that bond. But, man, it's just a collection of everything we do as a team, the walkthroughs we do. And everybody's excited to show up to work and find ways to get better.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. From Super Bowl 58 in Las Vegas, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Becoming sunny this afternoon, we'll see a high near 36. Northwest winds at about 15 to 20 miles per hour. Clear tonight, low 20s. For your Sunday, we'll start off with some clouds, then sunny again in the afternoon with a high near 37. On Monday, mostly sunny with a high near 40.
Currently 33 degrees.
Valentine's Day is here. This year, give the ultimate gift. Name a star after your sweetheart. This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. For 45 years, we've named millions of stars for celebrities, dignitaries, and individuals worldwide. For $59 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit starregistry.com, you can give the most memorable gift. The star you name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Visit starregistry.com or call 800-282-3333.
From I-43 to I-41. This is the Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM, WGBW.
Folks, if you are just joining us, you're listening to the Kripescast on Civic Media. So you do all this stuff, though. I mean, you've made it in terms of your own old standard, you know, by getting on Letterman. And then where are you at in a career standpoint? Are you happy at this point that you had made it, or did
No,
of course not.
It was funny. I got you know, because I had done all these things, I kind of had heat, right? I was like this guy, especially doing SNL, because they weren't using a lot of variety acts, but it was at this critical time during SNL when it wasn't that great. It was kind of like, I think Lauren Michaels had left and Dick Ebersol was running it, who was a guy from NBC Sports. So he didn't know a lot about comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And, so they booked me because it just was so inconsistent. And that's like the Joe Piscopo era, right? You know, and it just wasn't like, I think Eddie Murphy was in there too, but he was such a standout. But mm-hmm. It was a tough time for SNL. And I remember Joe Piscopo came up to me, he said this really profound thing. He says, "You're lucky." He goes, "You get to do your own stuff." He goes, "I have to go out and do this, whether it's funny or not. Like, I got to do it."
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it was really important. It was really amazing lesson, because it kind of kept me out of being like, I'd go out for auditions and stuff. Like the biggest show business story was Brandon Tartikoff, who was the head of NBC at the time. I think there was a show called High School USA, which was like a Michael J. Fox vehicle, and they wanted me to do it. And this is when I was at Gersh. This was happening when they were my agents, and they really wanted me. And I knew this wasn't a good role for me. Like, they were just putting me in as kind of a place marker. Like, uh-huh. Oh, we know he's funny, just put him in there. But it wasn't like based on me or anything. I wasn't an actor. Like, I could just do my persona and do my bit, but I didn't have that flexibility. And, they really wanted me to do it, and it was an on-air commitment for 6 episodes. And this is a long time ago, so it's $10,000 a show. And I said no, and they doubled it. So it's $20,000 a show for 6 shows. And I just said no. I said, I really like what I've done, and I don't think I'll come out looking good, even though I'll make a lot, you know, a lot of money in 1982 dollars or 1984 dollars, you know. I'll make a lot of money, but I just didn't want to do it. It just felt like that compromise that makes, like back then when you screw up, like I always felt like I just lose my audience. You know how it is. It's like jumping the shark, right?
Yeah.
It was like, I was really self-conscious about that. Like, I don't want to let the people down that like what I do, and I'm one of them. So I don't want to do this. So I passed on it. And that was kind of the end of it. Like, I just said, I just don't want to be on a sitcom. I was like 24 and I didn't think any of them were that great. And
yeah,
didn't think I could win at it. So I went back to Minneapolis and started over, you know, and I started designing toys, and I worked, there's a bunch of toys, you know, Tonka was in Minneapolis. And so I fell in with these toy designers. I wanted to be a toy designer. And then it was kind of like, it's so hard. There's so many prerequisites. The cost of the production of a toy, you know, is so nuts that it has to just find these margins. It's got to be fun. It's got to be cheap to produce. It's got to be fun to play with. I got one thing that got produced that got, like, they got it together for Toy Fair. It's like hanging on the wall in my kitchen. It's called the bubble fan. I took a fan and drilled holes. It was one of those suction fans, and I drilled holes in it and I put in bubble soap, and you open it up and it just makes like a ton of bubbles, right? It just like blows bubbles everywhere. So that's like the closest I got. And it was just like, oh, it's so hard. Comedy was like way easier. And so I started to kind of go, maybe I should do a show. And along this time, I was friends with Jerry Seinfeld, and he asked me to help him write his first HBO special. And so, but it wasn't really his stand-up. I did do a few things that he ended up being in his stand-up, but mostly it was to write the host segments, the wraparounds. So we worked on that, and that was like a great experience. And he kind of had this like great attitude. I mean, you kind of, as you know him, what you see is what you get. He's this really kind of happy. He's kind of like kind of joyful and just has a lot of fun. He had a great attitude, but he also worked at it like me. And so that really was fun for me to do that. And that was kind of got me going, you know what, I probably should go back and try to do TV somehow. And
first of all, I just want to take a beat and just say, like, it's a crazy interesting thing to start in comedy in Minneapolis, get to the point of headlining, go out to LA, make it, turn down what must have been a life-changing financial offer for you, in addition to probably a huge career opportunity, but you turn it down on the principle of it because you didn't like TV or the TV shows on at the time. It's really and then you make a toy for Tonka. I mean, you can see all the pieces of MST3K being put together.
It's all coming, right? Right, exactly. And also I did ventriloquism too, which is a big thing.
Right,
ventriloquist. So that all plays into it. And then, so I'm thinking to myself going, oh, this is cool. Like, Seinfeld likes my stuff. Like, we get along. It was fun. We had a great time making his special. And it was kind of like, I said, oh, cool. I know what I'm going to do. I want to write a science fiction comedy for Seinfeld. And so I started to write it, and I did drawings of it. And the next time we hung out, I showed it to him. And he looks at, and this is profound. He looks at me, he goes, Joel, this isn't a show for me. This is a show for you. And I just went, oh yeah, I'm trying to get off camera and be like a writer producer. And this guy says, you can't, you're not getting out of it. You're going to stay in it. So I started thinking about it, and it kind of was the beginning of MST, but really MST has some various things that kind of dropped on me that kind of said, oh, this would be a good show. So there's a couple of beats to that I can kind of explain, but it's not super, it wasn't like
Seinfeld said, here, you do the show. And then I go, pow, here's Mystery Science Theater. I'd kind of like had pieces of it, but it kind of got me in the place like, you know what? I should front my own show. I'm the most famous guy in Minneapolis right now because I did Letterman and SNL. I could get a show. I could probably get a show made. I have a chance at it. And so what I got to, the kind of the origin story of MST is a couple of things, but one is in college, there was a thing called the Turkey Awards. That was the Medved brothers wrote this. It was like a satire of the Academy Awards, but it was with bad movies. So it was like Plan 9 from Outer Space and Freaks and Terror of Tiny Town, which was like a Western with an all little people cast. It was kind of like this really amazing book that had all these B movies that were outrageous. And I remember being in college and my roommate had this book and I loved it. And I said, why isn't anybody making a show with these movies? They're like adorable. These are fantastic. And Robot Monster and stuff like that. And then the other piece of this is when I was in high school in Ashwaubenon, it all happened at, we were getting ready for homecoming and we were at the Wilkinson's house. And you can see the stadium from Wilkinson's house. It's that close. It's like a block from the stadium. And I grew up like five blocks from Kroll. So you know where Kroll's
went? Oh, sure.
Right?
Yeah.
Like I'm right in that neighborhood. So we parked cars on our front lawn. That's how close we were, right?
For Lambeau.
For the folks. Yeah, for Lambeau Field. And so we're at the Wilkinson's getting ready for the homecoming. Like we're working on the float. I think we're like twisting crepe paper. We made all our floats were made out of like chicken wire. And then you'd stuff it with this paper and make a shape. And it was like, we're working on that. And somebody put on the Elton John Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album. And I'm looking at the liner notes and there's all these illustrations, but there's one illustration that's got, the song is called I've Seen That Movie Too. And it's these silhouettes, theater seats, with two people sitting there watching like a Clark Gable movie. And I'm looking at it going like, that would be a great show. That would be a really funny show where you run a movie and have these people talk and like crack wise about the movie, but nobody's giving development deals to kids in Ashwaubenon at that time.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
So that dropped on me. The movies dropped on me. And I said, I'm starting to notice because a lot of these movies were in the public domain. So I figured I could do a show with public domain bad movies and these theater seats. And then the last piece was one of the things I did after I quit comedy was I started making these robots out of found objects. This all came from my stand-up act because I used to go to like the St. Vincent de Paul store and the Goodwill and just dig through bins of, you know, toys. And I a lot of my act was just made out of stuff like that. And I'd fabricate stuff out of, they called it bric-brac. The bottom of the basement of the St. Vincent de Paul store was tables and tables of bric-brac, which was just Tupperware and Wawa pedals and all kinds of crap. And so it dawned on me one day, I think I saw a documentary about Star Wars and they did this thing called kit bashing where they made like the Millennium Falcon was just made out of a lot of other model parts that they collaged. And I started going, God, it'd be great to make puppets like that. It'd be great to collage these robots. So it was like the most instinctual thing I ever did was I just got, went down to there. I bought a shopping cart full of plastic for $10 and I took a hot glue gun and I made this robot and shot it with paint. And I go, I think I just did something, just made something. And so I started selling those robots in a store called Props in Minneapolis. I sold like 70 of those robots. So
really
made 70 of them and got really good at it. And so that was the last piece. I go, oh, the silhouettes are the robots. There's a guy and two robots, which kind of comes from ventriloquism, where if like you're a really hot ventriloquist, you can do two dummies, right?
Yeah.
God, I might have to do the voices, but it was in silhouette, so I didn't have to have good chops as a ventriloquist. But
The original idea was I just thought it'd be me and doing the voices, but then the host segment became more and more important. I realized, oh, I should find people to run the puppets. But those are the beats that dropped on me. And then I go, okay, I got it. I think this is it. And so the last piece was meeting a guy in Minneapolis who did production. And that was a guy named Jim Mallon, who also famously is from Madison. He was with, I think his name, Leon Varga. And they were the guys who did the Pail and Shovel Committee at Madison. And they did the flamingos on the
basketball
Capitol steps. And they did the Statue of Liberty on Lake Mendota.
Oh, yeah.
I knew those guys. They were famous because when I was in high school, I heard about them and I ran for student government just being funny. And I won, just like did funny posters. And I totally got ideas from them, like some of their tricks. And so I met Jim in Minneapolis, and he was making a movie when I first met him. And then he approached me about doing a thing like the Gong Show. He wanted to do a comedy contest. And after that meeting, I go, oh, dude, I know a guy in Minneapolis who has production. He worked at this little UHF channel, KTMA, and he had gear. And I go, I'm going to pitch him Mystery Science Theater. I'm going to pitch him this show. And he liked it, and we made it. We did it locally. We did 22 episodes locally and really figured it out then. You know what I mean? Really figured it out. So at the end, we cut together an 8-minute cell tape of our funniest riffs, and then went, the guy I worked with on the Seinfeld special, the producer, Stu Smiley. So the producer of Seinfeld special was a guy named Stu Smiley, and he was the head of Comedy Channel, which became Comedy Central.
Right, yeah.
I went to him and I go, I got a show. And we showed him the tape and we got booked for like 22 episodes, and that was it.
So that's
the story, man, in a nutshell.
Yeah, I mean, that it's funny to see, because I think what's really cool about Mystery Science Theater is that it's sort of similar to the media landscape today, where it was ahead of its time, in that you could go out there and you could do the LA thing, or you could stay here and really build it and get your reps in and find the show in the Midwest, you know, and then when it's ready, take it out. But you kind of built your thing here, and you were able to do it from here for quite some time, which I think is very cool, very ahead of its time. And there wasn't anything else like it, you know. I mean, you kind of went to the what'd you call it, the brick thing? What was that, brick buying? In the basement of the Goodwill.
Oh, brick brack. Yeah.
Brick brack. Yeah. You have this brick brack of experiences.
Exactly. And then the other piece of it was the movie riffing, of course, was so undeveloped because we did the pilot. We did a little proof of concept tape to sell it. And it was like, I don't know, 5 minutes long. And my thing was really about the thing that, you know, you have the host segment, the doors open, you go down the doorway, and then you have the theater. It's kind of has this continuity. And that was just based on growing up watching movie shows, and somebody would kind of introduce a movie, and then the movie started, and they never tell you, like, what was happening? Like, how did all this shit happen? Like, how did it get on my screen? It's so disruptive. Like, is he turning on a projector? Are we looking? Like, they didn't do any explanation. You're just supposed to understand it. And so to me, the important part was, it's in a ship. This is the front of the ship. You go down a hallway and then you're in the theater. And that's what the pilot was about. Well, I just put a few jokes in. Like, I had one, it was the Green Slime was the movie we used for the pilot. And which is a super cool, like 60s, like Toho movie. And I had like a couple of jokes. The biggest one was, they said something like, that's a meteor. And I go, that's not a meteor. That's a battle station. So I'm like riffing Star Wars, right? I just had a couple jokes to go, oh, this is where we put the jokes in. And so once we did it locally, that's when we could feel your way through it and start filling in more and more riffs, right? You just feel it, right, as you go. Yeah. And just kind of make it as you want that density and that kind of feeling of abundance, right? So that's kind of what happened in those 22 shows we did locally. So then the other thing that was really lucky about the timing was MTV was really big and cable was opening up, and somebody said, well, we should do this with comedy. We should do a channel where we show clips from new movies and TV shows. And so our show just happened to fit in that, but they want us to move to New York. And we just said, oh, we're not going to do that. Our set is like built 4 feet off the floor. And we can't go in, and we're just not going to, we just said, no, it was too ridiculous. So we said, we got to stay in Minneapolis. Just send us the money and we'll send you a show. And it worked. So,
oh, that's cool.
They were hesitant, but our show was so cheap. It was like 35 grand a episode back then. So it was really inexpensive, even by those back in those times, back in 1989, you know.
And then you've had all these evolutions of the show over the years. Is there sort of like a sweet spot in time where you like, has it continued to go up for you, or is there like an era that you appreciate the best?
Yeah. Well, I think I like it all. Like, I like, you can kind of see our growth, like the trajectory. Like, for example, when we did it locally on UHF, I don't know, we might have done 70 riffs, maybe a show. Like, this was, by today's standard, very Spartan. When we went and did our first season, we went to 300 riffs. And then the next season, it was like 600. And so just it start, and then it went up to 700. It usually hangs around 700 riffs per movie. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where it's remained since then. So we kind of got to that level. And then I left the show because I was fighting, Jamel and I weren't getting along. So I left the show, and I was kind of set up to, if it kept going, I'd do okay because I created it. And I like those shows just as much, because those shows that I didn't work on are completely a surprise to me when I watched them, so I think they're really funny. And then about 8 years ago, I got in a position where I could bring it back. And so we did Kickstarter and raised like $7 million, and we were able to bring the show back, and now it's on Netflix. So we got 20 episodes on Netflix, and it's really nice to be able to just direct people, oh, you want to see my show? It's on Netflix. And so those were, that I like a lot, because we were able to really bring in an all new cast, new people. Yeah. And like Patton Oswalt is the henchman, and Felicia Day is the mad, and Jonah Ray is the host. And so those are the ones on Netflix. And and then we did another fundraiser, and we did our own streaming service for season 13. And so, that was also really a great adventure to get to even experiment with that, because Netflix didn't want to buy any more shows. So we created our own streaming service called the Gizmoplex, and that's still running, and it's, you can still go and check out the shows there, buy shows, or get a membership.
Yeah. It's what's cool about Mystery Science Theater is just the deep, deep fandom. Like, I remember watching it with my brothers in our basement, like all the time, because it was on, actually it was in my, it was when we were over at my Nana's house, because she had the cable. And right. So I think that's where it was. And then obviously once YouTube was there, you could watch a bunch.
Yeah.
Of
yeah. Too. It's still doing great on YouTube, and it's streaming on
streams.
So many, like Pluto and a million, you know, it's kind of a joke how many other streaming, like 20 other streaming services. So it's really out there now, and it's still doing good, I'm happy to report, you know. So it's kind of like, I think the Netflix thing made it really broad and brought in a whole new fan base. Mm-hmm. And a lot of old timers too that were there back in the day when it was on, you know, cable. So,
and the other thing is it developed like it kind of gave a lot of movies a second life, because you were obviously using a lot of B movies, a lot of movies that were sitting on the shelves in the public realm, but they started to gain some popularity after your show.
Yeah, too. Manos: The Hands of Fate is supposedly the new worst movie ever made. Yeah. So, and we found that. So there's things like that along the way that were super fun. And it is really weird looking at it over time, because you can't pull the movie out of the show. It's kind of like the movie is so much a part of it. And people are, I think our most famous shows are the ones where the people really like the movie just as much. It's not that we did especially great. Sometimes it is. But sometimes it's just the movie's so amazing and weird that people are fascinated. It's really, how did this get made before how did this get made? You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, looking back at it right now, what would you say you're most proud of with Mystery Science Theater?
Oh, man. I mean, one of the things, and I think you get to enjoy this with the stuff you do. We never got notes. It was such a unique, weird show that they never, I mean, when I was there, we never got notes. We never had someone tell us like, this joke won't work. And what are you doing? It was just, we did it. We were really monitoring ourselves and just doing what we thought was funny. And because it's a puppet show, we never got dirty, or, you know, when I was there, it never got that randy. And so I'm super proud of that, just that you can express yourself. You can be very direct. You don't need supervision from some development person who's doing notes and flagging certain words and stuff. So that was really it. And what you're looking at, man, is a totally creatively sated man. I'm satisfied.
Hey, this was super fun, dude. It really was.
Hey, cool. I appreciate your work so much. I'm honored to be on your podcast. I'm a fan and I'm super proud of you. You're doing great. And it's real good stuff.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, that's an honor to hear coming from you. I mean, me and my brothers, I told my brothers we were doing this. They were super pumped. And, it was just really exciting.
All right. Cheers, man. Take it easy. Bye.
We'll see you soon. All right, ladies and gents, that is it for my conversation with Joel Hodgson. You can find his stuff, joelhodgson.com. You can also go to youtube.com/MST3K, and you can watch episodes streaming on Netflix. Thank you all for listening to the Cripescast. Thanks to Colleen Maraca and Hannah Milos. And thanks to all of you. And make sure you watch out for deer, okay? And have a wonderful Valentine's Day. All right, we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
So roll out the barrel and get the band brewing. Life's got you down, just keep her moving. It's on Wisconsin, the Badgers say it's the old Wisconsin Jubilee.
You know, sometimes when you're ice fishing, you put your foot into walleye hole and go ass over tea kettle and you think you're done. No, you got to keep her moving.
From the home of the frozen tundra, Green Bay's choice for news talk, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW.
Hey everybody, it's Tom Oswald. Noon to 3 on Monday, we have a cure for your Monday blues and also a look back at what happened over the weekend. Join us on the Civic Media Radio Network.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s, time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.